Hello?
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 Hello? Hello? I think we beat Dr. Dave to it. Looks that way, doesn't it?
I know. I can't do it every other week. I was trying to check my email to see.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I think he said every Monday for 4 weeks running. Beg your pardon.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Oh, good. Okay.
Hello.
I'm in. Hi, Carol.
You're in. Yeah. Hi, Carol. I don't think Maria Dave is here yet.
Hi.
Marguerite.
How's everyone doing?
Well, well, I'm in Canada and we are not allowed to go anywhere.
But, wow.
From you guys?
No.
I was visiting. No. I'm in Palm Springs and I can't get out.
Oh, wow. That's nice. Wow.
Oh.
And where are you from?
Oh, I kind of hear somebody.
I hear
Dave. Dave's talking in the background.
Yeah, he's on my computer. But he's not on the phone.
Yeah, I can't hear him through my phone, though.
If you walk away saying it's one of the best seminar series I've ever attended, what would you walk away with?
Now, if I need contact.
Well, hold on a sec. Let me make sure this is... I'm going to make sure this is not... Wait a minute.
Hey, sorry, guys. I had trouble getting into my own conference line. I hope everybody's doing great. I know that a lot of stuff is going on that's challenging and unprecedented. And in one sense, who better to deal with this than people who are expert at making maps and dealing with new situations than coaches? And for those of us who work completely by telephone or video conferencing, it's an ideal time. I want to thank you so much for all of the responses that you've sent in answers to the questions and other feedback. I really appreciate that. First, I want to return to that in just a moment. But first question, how many of you did the exercise of the neural conditioning chart?
I did, Dave.
How did you find it? This is who?
Carlene.
Yeah. Well, great. How did you find it?
I really like it. I have been using it at a personal level and with some of my habitual responses in relationships. And I introduced it on a professional level, and I've been getting good feedback as well.
Great. Okay. Super. And remember that that page is in the exercises portion, the resource guide. It's well into it, like, you know, somewhere 10 or 14, but it's something that you can certainly peel off and use with clients if you find it interesting. Other responses? Anybody else tried it?
Yes, it's Marguerite.
Hey, welcome. Hey, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I use it, and what I found is that I have an emotional trigger right now with the COVID-19, where if I hear of a death or talk about death due to COVID-19, I would start to sort of binge eat or emotional eating. I would feel really, really hungry, very, very tired, and I found I was listening to the news late at night and then going to eat almost a full meal at night around 11 o'clock.
Okay.
So my shift then was to say, okay, when that happens, whatever time of day it is, I am going to wash my hands, drink some water, and if I do feel hungry still, I'll have something healthy. And that has worked. And I also wean myself away from the late night news.
Thank you so
much
for sharing
that. My ideal response.
You for sharing that. That has to be useful for a number of people. And that's a perfect example of something that's emotionally triggering. And then the content of that column too, whatever the content is, the negative self-talk, the action symptom like eating, whatever, that's the content. That's the result It's not the cause. Here's a story just to juxtapose to that. As you may know, as a psychiatrist, I had one of the first two or three major eating disorder treatment programs in North America. One thing that I heard, in 100% of the people who ate symptomatically, when I learned finally to ask them, and I treated a couple of thousand people actually, I would ask them, at what point when you ate symptomatically did you notice a change in your state of mind? 100% of them said, when they really looked at it carefully, just before the food ever entered my mouth. It was the idea of doing that action that created a state change. And think about the similarities. What we know now is that it's the anticipation of something that creates the state change, the anticipation of spending the money. When we hook up people who go to a slot machine, it's before they ever touch the machine that they get that spike of dopamine and the reward. We used to think it was the reward was the result of some action, but the reward, the dopamine, is the anticipation. So I think you're really sorting it out to look at what's cause and effect, and that's what the neuroconditioning chart will help you do, is to look at cause and effect, the trigger and the result, so that you can, as quickly as possible, move to the getting centered and grounded to move to the ideal response, the optimum response. And that's a microsystem of optimizing your performance and your behavior. So thank you for sharing that, and it's a great example of that. Anybody else have an experience with that?
Well, not with the neural conditioning chart, Dave, but I will tell you that I am so glad that I have taken all of the courses that I've taken, most notably the Money Story course, and I have to tell you that my personal response to the current crisis has been very measured, very mapped out, very calm, very guided, you know, reduce all debt. And so I feel really good, and I thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Because I think
that's really great.
That is great. It really is.
What you said reminds me of one of the comments, that one of the questions, what I'd like to get out of this that you sent in. Remember that what we're talking about now is not something to present to clients. It's not something to deliver to them. This is simply to inform your listening and your understanding. What we're doing, the way I'm talking to you guys is never a way I'd talk to clients who I do mentor coaching with. We collaboratively explore, and it's not about information. A number of you have heard me say, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd work out every day, we'd have a lot of money saved up, we'd eat mostly vegetables, a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But information is really not enough. And here's something to add to that. Despite compelling evidence to the contrary, we tend to rely on an already existing internal explanation to understand behavior. For example, we assume that since Michael Jordan was a tremendous basketball player, that we should rely on his expertise about the best underwear, or that Martha Stewart has actually even stepped foot in a Kmart or shopped there. So it's not about information. Science is about understanding patterns, the fundamental laws and principles that form the foundation of our lives and the world. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ, and so many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to the way the mind and brain work. I emphasized the two systems, the micro system that we've already talked about, the neural conditioning chart, and the macro system, the roadmap system, is a performance macro system to deconstruct and understand personal performance, to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior to optimize performance, and especially performing under pressure. We're going to come back to this, or we're going to address this in the upcoming seminars. Any other quick comments or questions before we move into our material? And I will go over for the added minutes of not being able to access our line. And I also wanted to mention, if you're interested, I'll add some time, like 10 or 15 minutes, to our final seminar after our seminar is over, after the top of the hour, so that we can just talk or discuss questions or comments or reflections that you have. Just to keep in mind with your schedule, if that's a possibility. So just briefly now, any other comments or questions or things to mention? Okay, well, I'll reserve some time at the end and go on lecture mode now for us to do the seminar. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance now and do an overview of that, beginning with a confidence blueprint. Olympic gold medalist Nardedine Morosselli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" My kind of woman, obviously. Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague in Houston, offered his version. When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two. Now, neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than either competence or expertise. Confidence is a state of mind. There's a little bit more on this with the blog that's archived on my blog section at my website, if you're interested in looking at that. Confidence is both art and neuroscience and initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. Here's one interesting example. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essay and provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two piles. On one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, "I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback on your paper." The essays in the second pile received a note saying, "I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations, and I know you can reach them." For the students who received the generic note, 40% revised their paper. For the students who received the encouraging high expectation note, almost 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections as in the first group. Belief and confidence, like any state of mind, is contagious. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have certainty, your brain will find a way. And here's what we know now from neuroscience. Good parents have known this for centuries, but we know this. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. That here's a sidebar to that. That's why it's important that we work with people in whom we believe, because it's that belief that will be the best thing that we can possibly give that client. Success most often has to do with two things: the state of mind of confidence that we engage an endeavor, and how we manage an optimum performance state under pressure-inducing circumstances. We're going to come back to that. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your actions. It's initially subjective. It's kind of like an emotional regard of a promise that you live into then to make it a reality. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. Optimism is a belief everything's going to work out. Confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. Let's circle back and apply that to the neuroconditioning chart to create an optimum state of confidence. Rather than starting with a negative emotional trigger, consider starting in your homework for this week, before we meet next time, consider starting with a positive emotional trigger. Here's one example. My daughter wanted me to join her to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the days that she was in college there. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run together the last 7 miles to the finish line. She learned how hard it was to qualify for the marathon with both sponsorship and time. After she got her doctorate and moved back to Boston to practice, it became a reality when she qualified and obtained sponsorship. She kind of became her own sponsor. For me, excited and horrified sort of blended. While I'm a lifetime athlete, distance running is absolutely not my thing. Running has always been in relation to some ball. I knew I would have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and pain of training to cross the finish line together. Now, one of my favorite sayings is, fate whispered to the warrior, you cannot withstand the storm. The warrior whispered back, I am the storm. Each time in training, when I would otherwise have quit early or rationalized about stopping because of pain, that mantra, I am the storm, sustained my effort. It was transformative in terms of my state of mind, and there was nothing that would stop me. Many I am the storms later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. Now, how does this actually work? The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain for rational thought and decision making. In brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. When there's stress, psychological threat, or anxiety, the challenge is to regulate state of mind to maintain serotonin and sustain confidence. Now, another transmitter that directly affects confidence is oxytocin. As you know, this is the chemical transmitter mediating bonding and connection, and it fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be important to others or to an internal ideal. The connection and the bonding of oxytocin works with your own internal ideal as well as with significant others. A conversation, think about how the way we began a conversation, the first few words, can determine the remainder of the mindset for that conversation. A conversation that begins with remarks perceived as authoritative or critical or adversarial activates the brain's defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze, mediated by stress chemicals like cortisol and adrenaline. The listener experiences some degree of guardedness, anxiety, or distrust, and closes down for self-protection. The subsequent conversation is then viewed from that mindset. Those first few words boot up the mindset that processes the remainder of the entire conversation. On the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system relating to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion induces a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention to the speaker, to engage with the speaker, and frames the remainder of the conversation. The listener feels safe, heard, and understood. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and result. This is the conversational intelligence that we use daily with every client. Building confidence requires, even demands, hard work, risk, persistence, and tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites for doing something, but the result of effective engagement. So let's look at this from a slightly different perspective. How can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? Here's an example of how not to do it. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, the coach has probably ensured it will happen again. That's from Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated. A common perception is that the best way to get employees or players to perform is by pointing out mistakes, threats, or being intense. While negative emotions grab attention, a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset and the associated aspects of bonding, loyalty, personal development, and commitment to a person or to a group. Priming of mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. Here are some basic strategies. These are in your outline for successful priming for confidence. Perhaps having a mantra for grounding and centering. Ask yourself positive, powerful questions to induce serotonin. Positive self-talk. There's an art and a science to self-talk. Recall a time of successful accomplishment of a similar challenge. Identify moments of significant confidence when you had a feeling of, I can do it, or whatever it takes. Focus on connections with important others to activate oxytocin response. Create mental imagery of specific success to live into. And cultivate a circle of supportive people and mentors. Think about this example for a minute. For those of you who have played the game Taboo, you have a target word on a card that you've drawn that you want your partner to say given your single word clues without gestures. Also on that card, below the target word, are a half dozen words you cannot use, the words that would make it too easy. For those of you who've done it, think about how hard it is once you've seen those six words not to say one of those words because your focus has already become anchored in those taboo words. If you say one of those six taboo words, you lose the point, you and your partner. Often what you should not say can frame and dominate thinking to make it hard to get beyond the taboo words to offer reasonable clues. Well, people have more confidence and comfort to go further when they carry the best parts of themselves forward. This is what we know from the whole body of work of appreciative inquiry that looks at how a person or organization can study and define the best that there is and then use information to build on what is already working. Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, was a guest of mine on a mastermind group and has a tremendous body of work and research on appreciative inquiry. And basically, just in a nutshell, appreciative inquiry shows three major aspects. Focus on what works, enhances what works. Ask about what you want more of rather than problems and barriers. Focus becomes reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive, open growth mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. So again, the first few words are the question, boots up a mindset. And thirdly, it awakens possibility, an aha experience. Dr. David Copperwriter has done extensive studies in applying appreciative inquiry by asking about problems creates a problem mindset in various corporate situations. A matched study group in these same organizations that ask about possibilities or success creates a success and possibility mindset. The question launches the story. So how you began each conversation. Think about this in your individual coaching, and those of you who do group coaching. How you began a conversation boots up a particular mindset, the conversational intelligence of collaboration, the appreciative inquiry of focusing on what works. And here's something directly pirated from parenting that has significant application in working with people, and especially I found it's of major use for coaches working with athletes. What we know from parenting is that when you begin by telling somebody what to do, by telling a child what to do, what happens? There's automatic pushback. That's their job description. Then they engage in ways to point out what doesn't work about it or why it doesn't work, and the pushback, it always goes to the logical, intellectual forebrain, and you get intellectual arguments out of a four-year-old that you didn't even know was possible. Now, if you do it slightly differently, if you're a coach, if you're a parent, if you're a mentor coach, ask a question. That engages in a collaborative way an exploration of possibilities. Parents know, for example, that they engage curiosity and collaboration by asking, instead of telling a child what to eat, which doesn't work real well, would you rather have the broccoli or the chicken first? Would you rather have the milk in the green or the red glass? What we know from neuroscience is this. People will commit to what they help create. This is also why, from another slightly different perspective, we began each engagement with a client by an empathic resonance with their experience so that we join them in resonating with their experience. Then they can go someplace new with us in a better way, in a collaborative way. So let's apply this now to mindfulness training and peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won 5 NBA championships. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at the University of Miami found that expert athletes who practice mindfulness for 10 to 12 minutes a day were more able to withstand emotional and mental demands of physical training and had greater resilience and more sustained focus. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing, such as your breath, to give it full attention. When your mind wanders, which it will, notice that it's wandered and move back to the point of focus on your breathing. When your mind wanders again, refocus again. Keep doing this and your focus and attention will become easier. Athletes who do this 10 to 12 minutes a day find that they have greater resilience and focus and concentration in their sport so that their performance enhances. Try it simply if you want to find a way to get to sleep more effective at night. Do this now. Close your eyes. Get in a comfortable, seated, upright position. Keep your eyes closed and focus only on your breathing, the flow of air in and out of your nose. As you focus just on your breath, relax your body. Attend only to your breathing, following its movement in and out of your body. When your mind wanders, refocus on your breath. Feel your whole body move and relax with your breath. If you have a thought, watch it come and go without engaging it. Continue breathing as your center. consider anchoring this state right now with a cue or a simple gesture or phrase. Finally, release your focus on breathing and simply sit, being aware of your relaxed state, of your body, and the experience of unfocus. Pause for a moment to gradually re-enter your usual awareness. Consider ending this brief meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time, as you're aware of the relaxed state of your muscles and the steadiness of your heartbeat. Open your eyes and gradually come back to focus on present awareness. In a number of studies, a focus on gratitude boosts energy levels, enhances resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body. In other words, it enhances performance significantly. This mindfulness training can be a specific, deliberate practice component for optimum performance. Physiological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress, and enhance performance. So, consider this, and this is an important aspect of what we're talking about this evening. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you despite spending a lot of time working hard at them? The prevailing theory for many decades held that experience was key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise, whether that was in sports or an intellectual pursuit or as a criminal mastermind, 10,000 hours. Yet, compelling research shows that we don't gain experience from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson has spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts. He studied the art and the science of how someone practices to become an expert and what they do to perform exceptionally. It's deliberate practice. And here's the zinger to that. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. Now, that will not happen for any of you on this line because you're doing continuing education, expanding your growth, your professional expertise just by signing up for this. This is usually a result of movement away from the learning zone to focus time on performing. An example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason for this documented finding is initially not obvious. The younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education, and experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and it should be widened by the years of experience in the trenches. But this is not the case. What we now know, the difference is deliberate practice. A conclusion reached by Ericsson and his colleagues is that with few exceptions, people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience doesn't make an expert. How someone practices informs how someone performs. The vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor proves significantly more effective than massive repetition or regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, athletes, consistent findings was that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. Expertise is not about the total hours of practice, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours makes the crucial difference. For example, Erickson and his team found that the number of years of practice had no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist was with his or her patients. He found that in a number of instances, significant expertise, such as with physics professors and practicing physicians, did not do nearly as well as newcomers in their respective areas. Repetition of the same experiences is different from deliberate practice focused on improving. In fact, practice itself can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark is making your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelination, of rewiring your brain and your nervous system. Repetition of specific intended motor skills rewires so that each time over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is that a skill performed in the wrong way can also become hardwired. So the solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or a coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles, and suggest ways to overcome them. These are four simple steps to change a behavior. Identify the goals, determine the mindset and behaviors to achieve them, develop an action plan, program new identity to incorporate the changes. Notice that the majority of these ways is to develop a system. Only one is about the goal. The other is about transforming identity once you've developed that expertise. So here are two challenges in changing any behavior, and you guys see this every day with clients. The mind's inclination to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. This is a bias to want immediate closure and predictability, even if it's not cause and effect, even if it's not the result you want. And secondly, the brain has wired repeated behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. This is why you get paid as a mentor coach, because you know these things and you know how to address them. So let's talk about the learning zone and the performance zone. These are two specific areas. The characteristics of elite performers in business, sports, and various endeavors are all similar and all start with mindset. We have two distinct mindsets in this regard, a learning zone and a performance zone. In a learning zone, the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master, and that includes expecting to make mistakes, to learn from them. Deliberate practice occurs in the learning zone rather than the performance zone. That's why it's called practice. In a performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible to execute what's been practiced. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance, getting in the zone and executing. Research on the deliberate practice mindset shows that anyone can improve with the right approach. If you're not improving, it doesn't mean that you lack basic talent, but it may be because you're not practicing in the right way. So here are five specific aspects of the learning zone that comprise deliberate practice. Focus on a specific skill to improve on. Getting better or the whole range of skills won't work. Specify a specific goal. Determine a challenge just beyond your comfort zone. Use feedback with repetition and adjustments on execution, then and there, not I'm going to do this different next time. And finally, engage the guidance of a skilled coach or mentor to correct mistakes and introduce new possibilities. And this is the key. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Practice of a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that incorrect sequence. The right kind of practice carried out over a sufficient period of time leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predetermined talent or ability. Only deliberate practice with expert information and mentoring will result in enhancing expertise and developing skill. Deliberate practice modifies the structure and the function of the brain, increasing the ability to perform skillfully. Deliberate practice always pushes a comfort zone. It employs a growth mindset to move just beyond the already existing comfortable repetition. Improvement always resides just outside a comfort zone. It requires full engagement to the attention of conscious actions and tolerating the discomfort. So, to conclude here, there are 7 framework principles of developing significant skills with deliberate practice. And this is everything sports, intellect, everything that your client could possibly think about doing. Choose an activity that you deeply want to improve. Establish a fixed time for practice. Limit practice sessions to perhaps an hour at a time to maintain intense focus. Establish specific concrete signs for improvement. At the gym I go to, or used to go to before the coronavirus, always on the PA system it says, what gets measured gets improved. And they're absolutely right. Connect with like-minded people who believe in what you're doing. Align what you do with your core ideals, your core values, so that all of you is going in the same direction. And then, this is our bread and butter, establish SMART goals. So these principles are the system that you develop for increased skill and performance. Here's an example. New York Times multiple bestseller Jeanine Roth, whose work I admire, was an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. In response to one of the questions about writing her book, Jeanine revealed that she never lets any writing be seen by anyone until she's done at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, and focuses. As part of this process, she gets feedback from savvy readers. I knew this as she is a buddy of mine, but it has always astonished me to hear it, but I knew it would astonish the group. So let's look now at deliberate practice and mental representations. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics, self-awareness. Self-awareness is the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned at all levels of self and performance and to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new information in order to change. Self-awareness is a particular system's understanding of the self to look both subjectively and objectively at patterns of emotion, at behavior, and at attachment to others, including communication. The abilities to see oneself, to recognize patterns, and think systematically, are important aspects of understanding one's own dynamics and the dynamics of others. And deliberate practice, then, is about developing mental representations that enhance and perfect performance. In other words, to incorporate it as part of your identity. Remember that the final step to making any habit or any behavior permanent is to incorporate it as part of your identity, part of your operating model of who and what you are. In fact, Erickson emphasizes that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution of skills. Deliberate practice is designed to make these rep- these representations improve over time. So let's look now at an overview of peak experience and peak performance. Do you remember a specific moment in a performance that you did or an outstanding play you executed? Peak experiences are personal moments of lasting positive effect, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that may be unusually intense and meaningful. These flashbulb moments of personal high points of exciting and fulfilling experiences can serve as an exemplary moment, a positive representation and highlight of a career or an entire set of experiences. These instances can serve as organizer and motivator for other performance-based activities, or set in motion a particular mindset to engage the remainder of the experiences. Peak experiences, like peak performances, are most likely to occur in a state of flow, a sustained state of mind that allows access to the execution of a skill already developed by deliberate practice. Flow is described as being in the zone. It's an ideal mental state for executing an activity with full access to the developed skill as well as the experience of enjoyment. Flow is in and of itself rewarding, pleasurable, internally motivated. It's characterized as a total immersion in an activity and relies on default performance activity without shaping by conscious direction or thought. If you have to think about it, it may be a choke. You get outside even for a nanosecond of that flow. Even a nanosecond of moving to that observer's platform or thinking about the performance can create a derailment of that automatic flow pattern. Elite performers have trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. A soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond of response. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instant of a cornering turn. I work with two race car drivers who describe this experience but have difficulty in deconstructing the elements of exactly how they do it. The link between perception and action, in other words, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous and precisely formed. I've also seen, as another kind of goofy example, the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, run at an amazing speed and be able to instantaneously shift course in order to avoid an obstacle as well as pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern development that I'm describing here is all installed by deliberate practice. One thing I want to mention just briefly before we wrap up is the last shot. And when I began playing basketball with my son and daughter in the driveway, we would never end on a miss. They had to make the last basket they shot before we stopped. It just was instinctive to me. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. Later, when I coached their basketball teams, each player had to make the last basket he or she shot before we ended practice. I just knew intuitively that endings make a difference. Even brief, seemingly meaningless endings of our driveway basketball or our Tuesday night team practices before the big game on Saturday. Later, I would learn of Dr. Daniel Kahneman's research on peak experience that the two times of the most impactful experience and subsequent memory are at the moment of greatest emotional impact and even more especially the ending. My son, 2 years older than my daughter, taught me about the importance of a performance state of mind many, many years ago. With his being the first team I ever coached at his age 8, we would gather together as a group at our home gym the day of the game, shoot briefly, and go over the few rudimentary plays that we had. The team would then all pile into my car. Remember, this was the era before mandatory seatbelts. And drive to the gym. We would play while listening to a raucous rendition of Eye of the Tiger this repetition, they all sing along at high volume, got everybody in the spirit before the game. A couple of years later, when I coached my daughter's all-girl basketball team when she reached age 8, we began each practice the same way, with a little inspirational talk, teamwork, moving directly into the basics and scrimmage. Well, it didn't work. They were distracted and didn't seem to respond as if there was something else they were there besides basketball. I was actually baffled. As I listened to them and observed more closely, I began to gradually sense what I'd missed. Basketball was the content of the practice, but their state of mind focused on the process of being together, of playing together. While I was urging them to concentrate on being competitive, they just wanted to enjoy themselves and each other. Soon enough, I learned. We began each practice sitting in a circle on the court, just talking. That was their warm-up, and it worked. They played much better as a team. Same thing for pregame warm-up. We all piled into my car and gossiped on the way to the game. How strange yet wonderful I thought it must be to be a girl. And to apologize when you foul an opponent was never a consideration for me. My daughter still contributes to my continuing education by giving me 4 granddaughters. So I want to talk just a little bit about unlearning, because we usually don't consider this, because we have to make a place for new learning. To engage new learning creates new possibility, new neuronal pathways and networks. But here's a study. Some of you have heard me talk about this before. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habit. Each day, the subjects picked a different option from poles of contrasting behaviors: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, and behaved according to this assignment that they picked. So an introverted person, for example, would act like an extrovert for an entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they behaved in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something they had never eaten before, and twice a week they would also read something they would have never done before. After 4 months, the remarkable finding was that the subject had lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. The weight loss impact was baffling in the beginning because it wasn't at all about a diet, but it was a study focusing on change and its impact. The rationale, requiring people to change behavior, made them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. This is story busting in an indirect way to create awareness of choice architecture. In having to process decisions actively, they exercise their choice and decision-making abilities, extending to other choices about what to eat and what not to eat. Once you become aware you're actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. Many actually indicated that they came to ask with each bite, is this in my best interest? The brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning must involve, at the same time, an unlearning. Why do you think it's easier for a child to learn a foreign language? Well, the beginner's mind is the essence of this process of not having to forget or unlearn something or to translate it internally. Inevitably, much must be unlearned in order to replace it with a new, like forming a new habit when one already exists. Learning is not the simple acquisition of information, but a practiced behavior that's introduced with already existing behavior in place, and some may be specifically in contrast to the new learning. So this is what you want to listen for with your client about what their assumptions, what their system already is to deal with this, because you have to deal with a new way of doing things, and you have to deal with their system at the same time. The old ways of doing things, such as an ingrained attachment pattern played out in the business relationship, is already there. A fact, a belief, an attachment pattern is an anatomical reality in your client's brain, so it's useful to know what it is and then how to deal with it. A habit simply means that you've, by repetition, rewired your brain to make a particular behavior or thought pattern automatic with specific cues. And once that habit's in place, it becomes the anatomical reality in your brain with corresponding neural pathways and networks that execute the habit. Simply presenting an alternate or a better pattern does not overwrite the programming already in your brain. Change can occur, but it's a process of doing a new behavior and undoing the old one that it replaces. These are the neural substrates of learning of skills, physical or cognitive. So, one thing I want to just highlight here about the ability to unlearn can involve strategically not engaging a default neural connection or to quickly disengage it when it automatically recurs. In other words, a new behavior needs to be side by side with the unlearning to gradually phase out the old behavior and neural wiring. Being aware is always the first step to recognize authorship and own the story that you're creating. You know, for example, you may have automatic thoughts that recur, negative thought loops, negative self-talk. And if you consider this as simply an error detection message from your brain, these are the three steps of self-directed neuroplasticity. These are three unlearning steps. If you have an old content or an old practice that you habitually engage, relabel that as simply an error message from your brain because your brain has wired it over time when you've repeated it. Reframe as a false brain message and not a directive for action. This gives you some distance. And then refocus to the desired or productive activity or process. These three steps can all be done at the same time. Error detection mechanism, reframed as a false message, refocus to what you really want or need right now. When we unlearn connections and associations, we weaken the chemical connections between neurons, which is also neuroplasticity, just in the opposite direction. This unlearning is necessary in our neuronal networks to create room for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, keep our neural networks from overload. So, one final thing that I want to mention here about how important it is, and you do this every session with a client, that you help them put things in an output channel. You'll do this, for example, by asking at the end from what we've discussed, how do you put together your understanding and what you next need to do? So they are putting in an output channel their summary, not yours, of what they've learned in this session and into action steps. So here's a simple example. If you were to take a test on a paper, 8 pages in length, which of these two methods would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row, trying to memorize them, reading the 8 pages once, putting down the paper and writing a 1-page summary. Research shows that the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in 50% greater success. When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways. You begin rewiring with the new information to complete the brain cycle. So the output channel completes the cycle. It's not passive learning. It doesn't just go in one direction. Repeated findings by various investigators show that this type of targeted effort involving active reconstruction of what's learned can increase learning on average tenfold. Here's a really simple example. In one study, when physician's assistants requested that the patient write the date and time of the appointment rather than doing it themselves and giving it to the patient, it lessened the no-show rate by 18%. It completed the cycle, and it ended up being a kind of commitment. So, no matter how much we acquire information, study and learn is by putting it into action, the output channel, that we enhance effectiveness and create a performance memory. Putting something in an output channel brings together both sides of the brain, emotional and cognitive, that allows greater synthesis and connectedness with expression. This process facilitates both attention and retention. It makes it your story. I know we're just past time, but we're in conversation mode now. Questions or clarifications, just briefly, that you have based on what we've talked about. And if you could manage background noise, I hear some conversation in the back. If you're not about to speak, would you please mute *6? Any brief questions or observations or any input any of you have? Thank you to those of you who have sent me input later by email, and I assume that's either because we ran out of time or because you listened to the recording again or for the first time later. I welcome that as well. And, again, thanks for all of the responses to the questions that I sent around. Any comment or clarification just briefly right now by anyone?
Hi, Dave. This is Maria Turner from Georgia.
Please, go ahead.
I love the comment you made on the meditation, because I remember I've meditated for about a year now. But I remember when I first started, you kind of beat up on yourself, like, oh, my gosh, I'm not focused. Like, oh, my mind drifted. But when I finally learned that it's okay, just come back to the breathing, it helped me to meditate longer and longer and feel good about it and not be stressed afterwards type thing. So that was very powerful. That was, you know, that made me think, wow, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and this is why that something like that brief mindfulness meditation can be so effective, not just for unfocus and for recharging, but to more effectively enter a state like sleeping at night if you do this focused breathing. It's the opposite of having new thoughts, activating different parts of your brain, and it really is mindful of the old adage about counting sheep. That was a simple, repetitive, monotonous thing, focused on one thing. Breathing does that instead of sheep. It, you know, the bed's way less crowded this way, and it's an effective way to use your own physiology as a point of reference. So it's entirely an internal focus.
Yeah, and I find that I sleep longer when I meditate before I go to sleep. I don't wake up in the middle of the night. I have a more restful sleep.
Add gratitudes if you don't already, and you'll sleep even better and longer.
Oh, yeah, I keep a gratitude journal, so yeah.
Super, that's great. Well, thank you, Paul, and if there are any things that you want to add or ask, send me an email or jot them down, and we'll begin here next time. Thanks so very much. I appreciate all of the input and the energy that each of you have done in our collaboration here, and I very much appreciate the suggestions and ideas. So we'll pick up right here next time. See you guys.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks. Good night.